All right, so we're still talking about the last day. This is lesson 9 in the books, the last day of Jesus, and this we'll be talking about the Jewish trials. Sometimes it's counted as 3 different trials during the night. Don't know if trial is necessarily the best word for all 3 stages, but what we have here are 3 different parts, at least, to this interrogation by the Jewish officials of Jesus that lead up to them sending him to Pilate, which we'll be talking about next Wednesday night. But tonight we're going to focus on the Jewish trial or trials or interrogations, whatever you want to call them. One of the points that the book makes and that the video will be making as well, that you would have noticed in your reading, hope you did your reading mentioned in the Facebook group and in the email, is that it talks about Annas and Caiaphas both being high priest. How does that jive with the law of Moses? I mean, 2 high priests? What do we see in the law of Moses? How many high priests was there? There was supposed to only be 1, and how long was his appointment for? For life, okay? But what we see in the historical record is that the Romans, when they came in and basically subjugated the whole area, that they did not want the high priest to stay in office for their entire life, and so they passed the baton around, and Annas was the legitimate high priest. He was high priest from about 5 BC to, I can't remember now what I read, 14 or so, AD 14, somewhere in there. And then he had 5 sons that became high priest at various points. And then his son-in-law is mentioned. Caiaphas is the one that is his son-in-law at this point. And so he's the acting high priest in the Romans' eyes. But the Jews apparently didn't appreciate that and, of course, still revered Annas as the true high priest, although Caiaphas certainly had a lot of sway with the Sanhedrin and with the Jewish officials. So that's just something that we need to understand so that when we look at the various passages that talk about the high priest, well, you've got to take a look at the context. Is it talking about Annas or is it talking about Caiaphas? Because sometimes, it'll just say high priest and you're not sure which one it is or why there's even 2 to begin with. So that's something to keep in mind as we go through the material tonight. Dave? It shows it's based in history.
Yeah, it really is kind of interesting. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to watch the video clip for tonight's lesson, and then we will have some questions afterwards. So if I could get, James, could you grab those lights back there for me, please, and then Mike or BJ, either one, if y'all could grab the other ones.
In the Israel Museum, they have a number of things that relate to the life of Jesus. But one in particular is the ossuary of Caiaphas, the high priest. During that time, when Jewish people died, they would have laid them in a burial chamber and wrapped their body. And after a year, the body itself has decomposed in what's left of the bones. And they would take those bones and put them in an ossuary, a bone box. And they found the ossuary of Caiaphas.
They have several ossuaries in that wing, and so you can actually compare. There are some that are very, very simple. And there's actually the ossuary of a crucified man that has a remnant of his ankle bone with the nail still in it. That ossuary is very plain compared to Caiaphas's. Annas and Caiaphas, they were the high priests, and I say that because really Annas was the high priest. According to the Jews, that was a role that you held for the duration of your life. But from the Roman perspective, that was a title they passed along to different people. The way that that political family maintained that role was to make sure that from the Roman perspective, different younger men within the family would rotate the title, but functionally, Annas was the one behind all of that, pulling the strings in the background. What the Gospels explain to us is that the men in that family had actually prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and they had been looking for opportunities to arrest him and kill him.
Well, Judas provided that opportunity for them. He approached them and said that he would be able to give Jesus over to them, identify him for them. And so that's exactly what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane. And of course, Jesus then was arrested, and he was brought to the house of Annas and Caiaphas, which would have sat on the western hill in the city of Jerusalem. It was a place that was high on the hill. Important people of the city would have lived there, and that's the location that we visited.
After Jesus was arrested in the garden, they would have led him up this way to the home of Annas and Caiaphas to begin that night of series of trials to condemn him. Now, we're in a spot that you think is really important to that story.
We're at the Church of St. Peter in Gallicantu. Gallicantu is Latin for the cock crowing. So this is the traditional location of where the house of Annas and Caiaphas was located, the same location where Peter denied Christ while he was here.
Now, from this spot, I can see the Mount of Olives in a spot just above where the Garden of Gethsemane was. There's an ancient, it looks like a first century road behind us. How would that have played a role in that night?
That road led from the upper city to the lower city here in Jerusalem. If you'll notice in the scriptures, Annas and Caiaphas and the people that were here did not seem to be surprised that Jesus showed up in the middle of the night. Right. Well, it's because they could see him coming. From here, you would have the vantage point of being able to see the torches in Gethsemane, and then as they led Jesus here. And this road that's behind us was probably a road that Jesus was led up.
Both Annas and Caiaphas could have looked out from their house, and they would have seen those torches go to the garden and then start making their way back toward them. And they would have known that their plot to arrest Jesus and ultimately kill him was in motion.
There are some things inside this building that I think give some credibility to this being an approximate location. Jeremy, look at this door. It's a picture of Jesus, and he's instructing Peter that he's going to deny him three times. And of course, we know Peter does that. Come on inside. Jeremy, one of the reasons why they feel like this could possibly be a location of the house is the fact that they found these 5th century Byzantine mosaics here. And if the Byzantines built a church here, they must have thought this site was important as well. Jeremy, here's a hole in the floor that sits above this holding cell down here. A prisoner would have been let down with ropes into this area. When we get down there, you'll be able to look up and see this from below.
So you're saying that the Byzantine church was built on top of this first century dungeon. There are a couple of hours when his trials with Annas and Caiaphas were completed, and before the Sanhedrin could meet in the morning, it's likely he could have been held in a place like this.
Even for important Jewish leaders, it would have been out of the ordinary for them to have a holding cell down in the bottom of their house. Whoever lived here was someone of importance who would have been in a position that they would have had the need to hold prisoners for either a trial or some sort of hearing.
On top of that, you have a number of mikveh, religious baths, on the front of the property, which indicates that this person is a person of means. They're a religious person, and other than ordinary people, they have what they perceive to be a need to hold people and restrain them down in the basement.
Jeremy, we're down in this holding cell underneath the bottom of this church. You can see up above there's a hole that we saw earlier. This would have been the hole that they would have let down a prisoner into this holding cell. This hole was originally a mikveh, which was a ritual bath, but it's obvious that it's been cut deeper for the purpose of holding a prisoner down here.
How ironic that a place where they would have been coming down to get ceremonially clean as a place where they would have lowered a prisoner and held them for a while.
This would have been a very dark, lonely place for anybody who would have been down here.
I've done work in prisons, and in almost every prison, there's a place that they send them for isolation, to cut them off from everybody else. And for anyone who had been lowered down through here, the only way out, a hole in the ceiling 20 feet up, they would have felt completely isolated. And we know Jesus felt similar to that, having all of his closest associates run away from him and give up on him. It would have been a very haunting experience.
And imagine any prisoner that would have been lowered down in here with the ropes tied underneath their arms, how uncomfortable that would have been. And of course, once a prisoner got down here, they would have left the ropes up there. And so if they looked down and saw the prisoner was sleeping or something like that, they could have jerked on the rope and, of course, woken them up. It's just another way of torturing them.
Now, there was something else that we walked past on our way down, a room that had some ropes on the side. Now, what was that?
That was a place where they could have punished prisoners if they wanted to. They could have stretched them out with ropes tied on each arm and on each legs, where they could have whipped a prisoner or done whatever they wanted to do with them.
We know that Jesus was mistreated during his trials with Annas and Caiaphas. We know that they spat on him. We know that they struck him. There was more that was going to happen to him when he was turned over to Pilate and to Herod. But he wasn't treated well when he was with Annas and Caiaphas by any means.
No, he wasn't.
We need to try to put ourselves in Jesus' position. He's been up for a full 24 hours at this point. This is probably one of the first moments being lowered down if he were put in a place like this, where he's finally calm into himself. But how isolated he would have felt, how tired he would have felt, and how these trials were the first time during this process where they had finally physically abused him, and what that would have felt like to have been so rejected by the people he was coming to save. There's a passage over in Psalms that might help someone relate to how Jesus may have been feeling in that moment. But I, O Lord, cry out to you. In the morning, my prayer comes before you. O Lord, why did you cast my soul away, and why did you hide your face from me? Afflicted and close to death from my youth up, I suffer your terrors. I am helpless. Your wrath has swept over me. Your dreadful assaults destroy me. They surround me like a flood all day long. They close in on me together. You have caused my beloved and my friend to shun me, and my companions have become darkness. It's really easy to imagine Jesus feeling that way in the morning hours prior to being sent over to Pilate and to Herod, as all of his apostles scattered from him and he had been mistreated and was getting ready to be sent over.
Regardless of whether or not this is the exact location of where this happened, it's still a vivid reminder of everything Jesus went through for you and me.
It was also during this period, just on the heels of the conclusion of the illegal trials, when Judas comes back into the story. It's my personal opinion that Judas never really anticipated that this would progress as far as it did. I think he assumed that Jesus would be able to walk away from this unscathed, really similar to how he walked through the mob that was trying to throw him off the hill in Nazareth when they rejected him there. And that when he realized that it had progressed to the point in the morning where the Sanhedrin found him guilty of blasphemy and they were going to take him to Pilate, is when he rushes back to give the money back and feels such guilt over that, and they refuse to take it, that he throws it at their feet, and then he goes out and hangs himself. I really believe that Judas didn't think it was going to go as far as it did.
The story of Judas is interesting and sad. One of the overlooks that you have there at the church looks over the southern side of the Hinnom Valley. And there is a portion of land over there that's been divided off, and that's the traditional site of the Field of Blood, the field that was purchased with the money that Judas threw down at the priest's feet when he realized what was happening. The other thing that's interesting about Judas is the fact that we have other people during the time of Jesus' crucifixion who did things they shouldn't have. Peter denied Christ. All of the other disciples fled. However, all those other disciples came back to Jesus. Judas had that opportunity as well. He had a choice he could make. He could have easily have come back to Jesus and said, "I'm sorry." But he didn't. There's a lesson for all of us in that, but it's a sad lesson that we have to learn.
In that one spot, you're reminded of Peter's denial, and you can see the potter's field where Judas chose a very different response to his guilt. He chose alienation from Christ and just wallowing in his guilt instead of coming back to a gracious Lord who forgave the one who denied him later on. I think it's a powerful place.
Okay, so what I want to focus on to begin with is at least for the bulk of this class, is the denials of Peter about Jesus and whether he knew him or was his disciple. We know, as we read the various accounts in the Gospels, that not only did Judas probably not expect it to go this way, but certainly none of the other disciples ever saw this coming. And they were all afraid. And Peter, though he was following to see what was going on and to see what was going to happen, he knew the danger that Jesus was in and that he would be in if he was found to be an associate of Jesus. And so his fear of his earthly life and, you know, the consequences took over at that point where he denied Jesus. My question, based upon your reading in preparation for tonight's class, what about Peter's denials stand out to you? And maybe what were some of the things that were going through your mind as you read about what was happening to Jesus and what Peter was doing? Amy? Yeah, so Amy says that something that she had never noticed before was when Jesus is predicting Peter's denials, he said that Satan has asked for you to sift you like wheat, is the terminology that's used, and that Jesus had prayed specifically for Peter that he would not completely fail, and that when all that was over, that he would come back and strengthen his brethren. That's pretty powerful. Would you like Jesus praying for you? Yeah. You want Jesus on your side? That's pretty cool stuff that Jesus would, you know, loved him so much and prayed that he would not completely fail him. What else, or what specifically maybe about that made an impact on you, Amy? Okay, that Satan had even asked for him and right, that's the difference that we see between Peter and Judas, isn't it? That, I mean, the guilt must have been extremely overwhelming for both of them. But Peter didn't give up. I want to talk more about that point in just a moment. Okay, what else? Carol?
Peter was so confident. I mean, his confidence is overwhelming.
Yeah, when Jesus is predicting Peter to deny him, Carol refers to his confidence, his overconfidence, which reminds me of another passage in the New Testament. Yeah, where Paul says, you know, you think you got it, you think you're standing up strong, take heed lest you fall. I mean, it can happen to anybody, but is it surprising that Peter would be one to make that kind of a statement? Doesn't that fit him? Doesn't that fit his personality and just his outspokenness and gung-ho-ness and so forth? But all right. Yeah, Lisa mentions, and this passage is always very moving to me as well, in Luke 22, when Peter denies Jesus for the third time, what does Peter do, or what does Jesus do at that point? Turns and looks at him. Can you imagine those eyes just staring at you? The eyes of your really good friend, your mentor, your Lord. And he knows exactly what's just happened. He predicted it. He said that he would do it. And Peter denied that he would do it, right? He said, no, I'm not going to fail. I'm not going to stumble. I'll die with you, Lord. And yet he did exactly what Jesus said he would do, and then Jesus turns and looks at him. Is it any wonder that he went out and wept bitterly at that moment? Yeah, Lisa says it was probably not an accusatory look, but a disappointed look, a sad look. Not a, hey, see, I told you so, you moron. No, that's probably not the attitude that Jesus had at that point. Yeah. He was fearing for his own life. Terry?
One thing that always, you know, Peter's denial is always, to me, it's not so much the fact that he did what Jesus told him he would do, but he did it as vehemently and as strong as he said he wouldn't do it.
Right.
And then the fact that he even cursed, you know, that part just really, I think, yeah. The first time I was old enough to really understand the fact that he cursed just kind of set you back.
Yes. Now, I'm not exactly sure what would be the content of that oath and swearing that is mentioned, and you know what kind of foul language they had back in the day, and if that's what it's referring to, or if it's simply referring to, you know, him stating in as strong as terms as possible with oaths and swearing and so forth. I mean, we sometimes use swearing in two different senses, don't we? It very well may be that he used some language that he shouldn't have used. I don't know. But he was very vehement in his denial. And Terry's saying just as much as he was vehement in his denial to Jesus that he would not forsake him, that he would not do what Jesus predicted. Yeah. Okay, James? Yeah, you'll notice in John 18, in John's account of these events, that there is another disciple that follows Jesus and the crowd into the courtyard, but then John goes on to say that Peter stood out by the door. I mean, he wasn't allowed in, but whoever this other disciple was allowed in for what reason? He knew the high priest, and apparently the household and so forth, and so him being accepted in was no big deal. They, you know, he was very familiar with those people, I guess, or at least some of those people. James points out that there is a theory that might have been John himself. We don't know for sure. It might have been. It might have been one. Doesn't have to be an apostle. You know, there were other disciples besides the apostles, but. In any case, this disciple, whether it was John or somebody else, you know, what was he doing? And maybe he didn't fear for his life to the same degree that Peter did, because they would have known that he was associated with Jesus, you would think. I mean, that's what I was wondering about. Yeah. Right. That's one of the... one of the arguments against it being John is that John is from up by the Sea of Galilee, a fisherman up there. So what kind of relation would he have? And we know that for the past 3.5 years, he's been with Jesus pretty much everywhere, and the vast majority of those years have been spent up in Galilee. You know, we don't know. But this disciple somehow or another knew the high priest, and I think it's obvious that they knew that he was a disciple of Jesus because the question that the first servant girl asked Peter is, are you not also one of his disciples? Indicating that she knew that, well, this other person was a disciple, whoever this disciple was. And so, aren't you a disciple as well? Linda?
Not only did Jesus predict that he would deny him, but that he would deny him 3 times before the rooster crowed.
Okay, that's right. He knew that he would deny him, and that he would deny him 3 times, and that's exactly what all 4 gospel accounts record. Okay, what else stood out to you, or really made an impact on you. Terry?
To get back to the statement James made about, you know, with Jesus, what all he's going through, he still took the time to, you know, that kind of makes you wonder, had it not been for that look, would Peter have been as sorrowful? Mm-hmm. You know, was it that look that just really cut him to the heart, or was it the fact that he recognized and realized that he just did what Jesus had told him to do?
Well, that look certainly put him over the top, I think. And here's what I didn't think about before until getting ready for this class tonight. It is very possible, based upon the rest of the events and statements that are made about the disciples and their distance from Jesus from this point forward. I mean, like when he's on the cross, who's there at the cross? Okay, John is the only disciple mentioned, or the only apostle mentioned at the cross, but who else is at the cross that's named? Okay, his mother, obviously, and then Mary Magdalene is mentioned. Those are the only, I think those are the only names. It mentions that the other disciples and other women were watching from a far distance. Okay, so I would assume that Peter would be one of those that were watching from a high distance. A far distance. Okay, so here's what I thought about. That look that Jesus gave Peter might have been the last time he made eye contact with him ever in his life until after his resurrection and appearance to Peter. Might have been. Because at that point, I mean, he's taken away and he's going to be before Pilate, and I mean, maybe they looked at each other, but I don't think that there would have been any opportunity, at least, for Peter to have said, you know what, Jesus, I messed up. I'm so sorry. And so think about that. That guilt that was with him, and here, this is it. And within a matter of hours, Jesus is dead. And he never took the opportunity or never had the opportunity, combined those two, to talk with Jesus about that. When the women came and told the disciples about the empty tomb, who was it that jumped up and ran? It's Peter and John both. Yeah. So that doesn't surprise me. Number one, that fits his personality anyway. But, I mean, you've got this glimmer of hope, I think, maybe in Peter's eyes, and Jesus isn't there. But just think about that. That may have been the very last time that he had that personal look with Jesus, and it was that look of disappointment and sadness and him knowing what he had just done. And then Jesus is taken off and crucified. David, did you have your hand up?
I don't think the look had anything to do with what Peter just did at all. The look had to do with what Jesus asked him to do after it was over, or what he told him he needed to do, in my opinion. When Jesus told Peter that he was going to deny him three times, as far as Jesus was concerned, that already happened. He just said, the devil's going to sift you. He's asked to hammer you. Well, Jesus is in the process of being hammered as well. And they have been brothers in arms, so to speak. So to me, the look probably had something to do with, are you strong enough to come out of this? Are you made to deal with what you're facing? What he was facing was not the challenge of embracing Christ and confessing him in public. What he was dealing with was the guilt of having denied him. And that was where the devil was really going to challenge him. And you know, I think
that's a good thought, and it may have been that or maybe both. I don't know.
It'd be like two soldiers that have been trained in battle, and one's taken prisoner, and he turns and looks at his comrade, and he's taken prisoner in a different direction. What is the look exchange between the two of them?
especially if one of them was responsible for having been taken prison, or both of them. The look that would be exchanged between the two of them is kind of like a communication where I'll see you on the other side, right?
Granted, we are speculating about what was in that look. With Peter's reaction immediately afterwards to go out and weep bitterly with that guilt, my first thought is the disappointment look. But it could have been the other, regardless of what exactly the look conveyed.
Why would Jesus be disappointed?
Because his...
Well,
just because you know something's going to happen doesn't take away the hurt or disappointment of it.
That's my point. The disappointment, whenever Jesus became fully aware, I think Jesus beyond that is, there's no need for him to be disappointed. Exactly what he expected to happen, it just happened. The question was,
well, and thankfully, of course, Peter does not give up, like Amy was talking about a moment ago, and that he does turn it around and becomes, of course, one of the main pillars of the church and strong members and apostles of the church. So something else that I noticed that I was cognizant of, but I'd never really thought about much, was the amount of time that transpired between the arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane there on the Mount of Olives to the time that then he's before Pilate. So all that time of the Jewish trials is what I'm talking about. The arrest there in the garden would have been somewhere around midnight, give or take a little bit on either side. We don't know for sure, but it would have been somewhere around midnight. And then by the time he's in front of Pilate, it's early morning, so maybe 5-6 o'clock or so. And so you have this 5-hour window that all these events are taking place. That the first stage is to be taken before Annas. That apparently does not last very long. If you look over at John 18, you'll see this interrogation before Annas. In John 18, in verses 12 through 14, that's when we're told that he is taken to Annas first, and then we have the first denial of Jesus, and so by Peter, and then so skip down to verse 19, and it continues. The high priest, which in this context was Annas, the high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine, and so you have a very short exchange, and in verse 24 it says, then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. So you have this first section that wouldn't have taken too awfully long, but the longer trial, the longer hearing would have been before Caiaphas, and that's what's recorded for us, that we hear them having all the false witnesses come forward and trying to find something to stick. And what was one of the accusations that's mentioned that these false witnesses brought forward? That he was going to destroy the temple and do what? Rebuild it in 3 days. Okay, but they couldn't agree, the text tells us, they couldn't agree with each other, these false witnesses. They couldn't get their story straight, in other words. And so that part of the trial probably lasted an hour or longer, maybe even upwards of a couple hours. And so we're dealing with the wee early morning hours, 2-3 o'clock, that he's before Caiaphas. And it's during this period of time that John tells us, and the other Gospels as well, that the next two denials of Jesus from Peter happened. Okay, the first one happened almost right away, so while he was with Annas. And then Luke tells us that there was about an hour between the second and third. So there's a long period of time is going on here and transpiring between all these events. And then once it was daytime, so around 5-6 o'clock in the morning, is when the third section of this hearing interrogation trial took place, where all the Sanhedrin are gathered, and they basically make a formal declaration of what they've already decided before Caiaphas, and that is, he's worthy of death, so we need to send him to Pilate. In that time frame, there's about 2 hours, and they mentioned that in the film as well, there's about 2 hours, probably, that he would have been held while waiting for daybreak, while waiting for them to be able to gather all the Sanhedrin together, all the council together, make that formal declaration of guilt, and send him to Pilate. And what were some of the things that were taking place in those 2 hours? Say again. Beating him. Hitting him on the head with their hand. Spitting on him. Right. Yeah, they so telling him to prophesy, you know, beating him and saying, who did it? Mocking him. All those things that we read about there would have taken place after his time in front of Caiaphas and before he went to Pilate. Yeah, it was the Romans that put the crown of thorns on him later and did some other things similar to this. But while he was there with Caiaphas, he certainly was not treated very well at all. Okay? What else do you see about the Peter and his denials? Anything that stood out to you? Okay.
I never had thought about that time frame before. And that even leaves me wondering more, you know, after Peter denied him the first time. What was he thinking about for that next 2 to 3 hours before the second and the third denials? Did it not come back to his remembrance what Jesus had told him?
Well, I think that the 2 to 3 hours, or maybe closer to 2 hours, where he was, you know, being held, that would have been after his second and third denial. But either way, yeah, what was he thinking about during that time? Yes, there was. I think, though, if I understand the reading of the of all four texts when you put it all together, I think that the three denials of Peter all happened during the time of Jesus before Annas and then before Caiaphas. And then you have about 2 hours where he would be maybe in that very holding cell that we saw, maybe in one like it, but in that area there. And so that would have been after Jesus, or after Peter had already denied him. Okay. Somebody started to say something? Yes, Judy. Or Amanda, rather. Caiaphas was just, he was the one that held that role based upon the Romans, and so he would have been the leader of the Sanhedrin rather than Annas, even though technically Annas would have been the only legitimate high priest. But the Jews had to live with the Roman system, and so Caiaphas was the one that got his hands dirty the most. Yeah. Okay, so very quickly, and this deserves more than the amount of time we're going to have to talk about it, so I encourage you to do your own study on this. I asked you to be very observant in your reading and see if you were able to pick out something that stood out that maybe would be a little bit odd. Did you catch anything that threw you off in your readings of these four accounts of these same events? Okay. Well, it wasn't John, it was Mark. But, yes, but Mark talks about the rooster crowing twice. And that's in his accounts, in Jesus' prediction, as well as in his account of Peter denying him, that there were two rooster crows. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. That is something else, or that is something that may be odd and throw you off and wonder, well, do we have a contradiction here? What else did you notice? Any differences between the Gospels?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in one reading, it sounds like it's the same servant girl that makes the accusation about Peter the first time and the second time, and then in another reading, it sounds like it's a different servant girl the second time around. And that's one possible sticking point that we could discuss. There's another one. Yeah, well, that is kind of neat. I didn't really pay attention to that until I read in the material that with each denial, Peter moves further away from Jesus, both physically and spiritually. I mean, he moves out. He keeps moving away from where Jesus is. Let me ask it this way. When did Jesus predict Peter's denials? Did you catch that? Where were they when he predicted Peter's denials? Okay, Mount of Olives is one answer. But Matthew and Mark will tell you otherwise. Or excuse me, Matthew and Mark will tell you that it's there on the Mount of Olives. But Luke and John, where do they place the prediction of Peter's denials? Luke 22 and John 13, they place it while they're in the upper room immediately after the Passover, immediately after the supper. Well, which is it? Is it before they leave to go to the Mount of Olives, or is it while they're on the Mount of Olives in the Garden of Gethsemane? This is one of those things that skeptics will use and say, see, here's a contradiction. That's a contradiction only if there are no plausible explanations, and there's a very, very plausible explanation that I think would be obvious, and that is the answer is both. And two of the gospel writers record one, and the other two record the other. That while they're in the upper room, and I encourage you to go back and read those passages that I suggested you read and see the placement of them, that he's talking to Peter and telling him what's going to happen. And then the Mount of Olives, you've got him reiterating some of the same things. All of you are going to be led astray. All of you are going to leave. And Peter says, no, 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 not me. And so he tells Peter again, no, you're going to deny me three times. And so I think you've got a similar conversation happening both times, shortly, a short time apart from each other, where Jesus is having to tell Peter again, no, you are going to deny me. So you got both of those, I believe, would be the answer to that. James? The next thing, and I'll to segue into that, is how many times did the rooster crow before Peter denied Jesus three times? Mark tells us there were two rooster crows, and Mark is the one that tells us that Jesus predicted that he would deny him three times before the rooster crowed twice. And so in Mark's account, you have the rooster crowing twice. James just suggested, well, maybe Peter told him twice, or Jesus, I don't even get all these names all mixed up, that Jesus told Peter twice, and maybe that's what the twice is referring to. I don't think that fits very well, especially since Mark does point out the initial rooster crowing and then the second rooster crowing. I think that emphasis is being made there. But this is another major area that skeptics will say, well, here's a contradiction in the Bible. Jesus in Matthew, Luke, and John say that the rooster was going to crow only once, whereas Mark says it was going to crow twice. Lisa, you immediately said no. Why do you say no? Okay. Yeah. Didn't say how many times the rooster was going to crow. How many of you grew up with, or maybe even still have, chickens and roosters? Do roosters only crow one time?
When you say a rooster crows,
Here's what I think is the easiest explanation of this. Number one, and this is true of any history, secular or Bible history, and that is that the writers are not trying to capture necessarily every single detail of every single event, and they are very selective, and sometimes they paraphrase, and sometimes they conflate events into one, and they just are getting the gist of what was going on. Mark, very, very, very old good tradition that Mark got his source material from none other than Peter himself. So it's no surprise that Mark would include this particular detail about the two crowings of the rooster, whereas the others would not. And so the point is, they're just saying, hey, Peter was going to deny Jesus, and then the rooster was going to crow. And that's exactly what happened. Mark just happens to mention that it's twice. You'll hear another explanation that maybe it's referring to the third watch of the night, which was commonly referred to as the cock crowing. And so Jesus was saying, well, before the end of the cock crowing period of the night, you're going to deny me. Maybe, but the very specificity of the cock crowing twice in Mark kind of makes me not count that one too awfully high. And it's not that we're telling completely different stories. We're just telling a certain version of the story that does not necessarily go against the other version. It's just that we're pointing out some details that the other person's not pointing out. We're emphasizing certain things, and every history writer does that. It's not something out of the ordinary at all. And so there's really no issue here. What you have are complementary passages rather than contradictory passages. And when Matthew, Luke, and John, they're just, and I mean, for crying out loud, Luke doesn't even mention the trial before Annas. Neither does Matthew and Mark. John is the only one that does that. So does that mean that that's a point of contention as well? No. It's just another side of the coin. Very quickly. We are so quick to point our finger at Peter. How awful that was. Raise your hand if you're just as guilty as Peter in denying Jesus at some point in your life. Don't we do that when we decide that our way is best, or that I don't want to do what Jesus says, or maybe there's that person at school or that group of kids at school or the people from work, and we're intimidated to stand up for what we know is right, and we keep our mouth shut, or maybe we, worse, go along with it. Has that ever happened to any Christian besides Peter? Absolutely. They all fled, and Peter and this other disciple were the only ones around, apparently, to watch it. So, do we need to be hard on Peter? Well, yeah, to a degree, but let's make sure that we learn from Peter's mistakes. And something that we're not going to cover in our material, though, is the graciousness and forgiveness that Jesus offers Peter. And you see that in John 21, where Jesus has this conversation with Peter and asks him a question three times, which parallels the three denials. Do you love me? Yes, Lord, I love you. Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. And I think that goes back to that point, in that passage where Peter or Jesus foretells about him denying and saying, when you come back from this, strengthen my brethren. Jesus welcomed him back with open arms. As much as Peter did, he forgave him. And it will forgive you and me as well.